Anyway, Martin laid out the interior structure of the body as well as the exterior surfaces for the car that became the hardtop Mark I Continental. And this was a beautiful piece of work that Martin did. And the way things would work at that time was that when we in the design department had a clay model that was approved, and we, Emmett and I, or some of the other fellows, had taken the offsets off with the measuring bridge, had taken the offsets off the car. In other words, we had measured the different sections at the zero line, 10-inch, 10, 20-inch line, and so forth and so on. Why, various draftsmen, body draftsmen, would be brought in from the body engineering activity to put these sections on a full-size draft and clean up the lines and get the surface anyway, defined, trued up, so that they could take the draft back and into the body engineering activity and do all the structure and the hinges and everything else that goes into a body. And some of the fellows that I remember from the body engineering activity that would come in at these periods would be Tom Stevenson, first of all. And he had a hell of a sense of humor and was just an outstanding guy for skill. And he had a couple fingers missing from one of his hands, but boy, he would lay these sections on and true the lines up and come back and tell you you had a little flat spot or a little hole in your model here or there, and damn it, he was always right. And Guy Manuel was another one that I remember, and I think Guy eventually used to be head of truck body engineering before he retired. The others, I can't remember any particular names. But I do recall that we looked at all the curves and sweeps that these body engineers had, and sometimes during lunch we could get a sheet of plastic and trace their curves off and saw them out on the jigsaw and file them smooth during our lunch periods and make our own sets of curves. We couldn't afford to buy them at a drafting supply house. They were just too expensive. Then I have a very fond reaction and recollection of Edsel Ford, who of course was the sponsor of this whole activity. And when he visited to look at our work, I recall that he was extremely quiet, very tastefully dressed, just a real gentleman, and his pants cuffs were precisely at the right height, and I think his shoes were the first pair of hand-benched English made shoes that I ever saw in my life. And he was very mild-mannered. He didn't bluster or stomp around the place. He'd sneak in quietly, and Mr. Gregory would be told that Edsel was there, and they would proceed to confer, and we would get the hell out of the way. But Edsel was just a fine gentleman, and I guess there's a lot of history that shows that the old man and the crew of bandits he had there pretty much were responsible for putting Mr. Edsel Ford in his grave prematurely. One of the other people that came into the design department was Bob Thomas. Now, he has retired and lives in California. He's a musician. He plays piano and organ, and was a guy that had organized a small band there and used to practice in the basement of the design center in later years. Anyway, his name was Robert McGuffey Thomas, and he was related to the McGuffey Reader McGuffeys. And I guess through that connection, he came into Ford Motor, and it seems like you had to know somebody. If you knew somebody who knew Henry the First, of course, well, you could come in pretty much and get a job. But Bob came in initially to help the fine artist that was up on the second floor doing work exclusively for Henry Ford. And this fine artist's name was, as I remember, Francis Bacon. And Bob was brought in to help him, which he did for a while, and then he got transferred down to the design department and worked with the rest of us on models or sketching up design proposals for wheel covers and everything else. And Bob told me in later years when I went to visit him in California that Bacon told him he'd never make a fine artist and he'd better get his ass someplace else if he was going to have a good career. But one day, Bob Thomas, he was about our same age as Emmett and myself and a couple of the other trade school guys, so we had a rapport. And one day he came in with one blue sock and one green sock on, and we started a needle, Bob, and it came out in the discussion that he was basically colorblind, if you can imagine that. So what Emmett O'Rear and I did was Bob used to use colored pencils in making his renderings, and they all had a number on them corresponding to the particular color or shade of color that they were. So we made a little chart of happy color combinations that he could use, so some of his damn colored pencil renderings weren't so wild for color combinations. I don't know, with the popularity of Picasso, it was probably later on, it was unnecessary. But anyway, this was our contribution to Bob Thomas's color blindness problem. Benny Barbera was, not independently poverty-stricken like most of the rest of us. He had a car, and I suspect his mother and father were both living. But anyway, when Monday morning would come around and the guys would come back in to work again, what you did on the weekend was subject of lunch hour conversation. And Benny was one of the guys that considered himself quite an operator with the girls, and whom we used to joke with and have a lot of fun with. And I remember one time we asked Benny what he did previous weekend, and he was an East Sider, as I remember, would be a patron of the Vanity Ballroom over there instead of being a West Sider like myself, where we went to the Grandy. Anyway, we asked Benny what he did. Benny said, I was out with one of those Grosse Pointe Debenans, or whatever you call them there, whores. And, of course, we almost died when he provided that definition. But Benny kept on as a modeler, I understand, and just retired again a few years ago. Well, as to section four here, which I've titled Some Comments on the Activities of the Design Department and their Philosophy in this 37 to 42 time period. And I've mentioned Beneke's modeled, not sculpted, philosophy for getting a pleasing surface. And there were various ways that you could develop a design. One way was to start by doing a full-size blackboard side view and perhaps end views or some cross sections. And then you'd complete the shape on the drafting board using various trade secret keys to handle transitions in shape and to define the shapes between what you had established as key sections. And then you'd convert this information into a full-size wood or clay model. And this type of approach is what I feel gave General Motors products their architectural hard feel compared to Ford, who started the process really with a full-size clay model at the earliest stage, then took information or offsets from it and cleaned up the surfaces on the drawing board and went ahead with the engineering. Now, I remember either I or Emmett and I made the little form sheet, graph paper type form sheet, for taking sections off a model using the bridge. And we constructed this sheet with a form sheet with spaces for the name of the program and the date and what particular section it was, whether it was vertical or horizontal, and at what line. And we would read off these dimensions and give this sheet to plot the dimensions on this graph, give the sheet to the body engineers, and as I mentioned before, they would go ahead and clean it up with their curves and then join the different sections and come back and tell us that, sure enough, we had a flat spot on our roof here or something of that kind. Type of philosophy was exemplified initially by this 1938 Zephyr front end, which had a low grill. It had a ship-type prow to it as the hood came forward and went down below the bumper. And there was flavor of some of these European race cars involved there. And that first 1938 Zephyr, I think, had a low grill with horizontal bars. And the next year, I helped model the 39 facelift, which was used the same sheet metal and grill opening, but it had a grill with vertical bars. And Dick Beneke helped show me how to proportionally space the bars as they went from the bottom behind the bumper on up, swept up over the bumper. And the bars would not only be spaced wider as they went up, but the bars themselves were wider. So it was a tricky little thing to make right, but when it was there, it was a real improvement on the 1938 design, and it carried the flow lines of the, what you might call a catwalk area between the fender and the hood. It carried the flow lines there right on forward and down and behind the bumper. The company at that time was not reluctant at all to look at competition and pick up ideas or design features that they considered striking and attractive and perhaps better than ours, or at least worthwhile putting on a new model. And I remember I was assigned to work on the front end of a Lincoln major facelift, and I'll be darned if I know what model this turned out to be, maybe a 41 or something like that, 40. But the competitive car that was considered very, very smart was this Cadillac Model 60 Special. And it had a greenhouse, it had a window section that was outlined, as I remember, in very thin chrome moldings, like a quarter inch thick, and it gave such a formal, elegant look to that car that it was considered by everybody a very smart, very fine design. And so what was done is the company bought a Cadillac Model 60 Special and brought it through the Golden Oak doors and sat it right next to where I was to work on this Lincoln front end facelift. And as a result, we made what I thought was a pretty architectural, ugly, heavy looking front end, but it was inspired by this Cadillac 60 Special car. And I think that the Lincoln kept that front end until following World War II. One thing I hinted at before is that people in those early days in the design center were pretty much jacks of all trades to an extent. We could make drawings, we made templates, we cut out letters for the instruments, we helped Gar Evans paint the models in some cases. We could bring in things that we had created at home, throw them in the pot for consideration, and so it was a delightful environment because I enjoyed drawing, always did. And keep in mind that while I was working there all the time, I was getting this engineering education at night, so I could appreciate the you might say, what went behind the surfaces. And with descriptive geometry and some of the drawing courses I had, why I could tell what was necessary to create some of this stuff and to pass on the information to somebody else that had to put it into actual hardware. So it was delightful to me, because as I would get more advanced at college, I could apply more and more of what I was learning to my actual work there in the design center. And I still to this day admire the type of drafting that the body engineers were able to do, and in fact were forced to do, in developing surfaces and cleaning them up so that the die models and dies and final product would be smooth and pleasing. Of course, today, which partly stems from the aircraft industry, the surfaces and the equations for conic sections and whatnot have pretty well been computerized, so that a lot of this hard body drafting work is done pretty automatically by the programs that are stored in the computer. But anyhow, the design philosophy that the company was following resulted in the rounded shape of the 39 Mercury, where the roof had a fair crown in it, and it curved down to quite a slopey tumble home, and then, or window plane, and then curved back in fairly sharply to the running board at the bottom. And I've already mentioned the 38 Zephyr and 39 Zephyr front end that had the curved shapes. One thing that perhaps has been lost in the company history is that there was some early concern while I was there on passenger safety. And I can remember what this stemmed from was that there was in the Detroit area, a famous plastic surgeon named Dr. Claire Strath. And I think he built a hospital, and I believe his son followed along in his practice. But anyway, Dr. Claire Strath wrote a letter which Bob Gregory got, and he included several photographs where he was relating the surgical work that he had to do on a patient to repair the facial cuts and damages of this fellow being in an accident and colliding with the steering wheel and the choke and throttle controls, which protruded from the instrument panel. And he had a picture of this car, the interior of the car, after the crash had taken place. And he was, in effect, telling us, why the hell don't we do something about this so that people don't have these sorts of problems? Well, the following year, and I don't know whether it was 41 or 40 or whatever, we actually recessed the choke and throttle knobs into the instrument panel in sort of hemispherical depressions as a result of looking at his pictures and trying to do some small thing that would help. Now, our analysis was no damn good at that time, because what was happening was that in a frontal crash, the engine and the control rods for the choke and throttle, being rods, would move rearward along with the engine, and that's what had caused these knobs to stick out. But we were, I guess, too dumb to figure this out at that time. But anyway, that was like the first concern of crash safety that I can recall there at Ford Motor, and that's a long time back. In the design department, there were a few innovations that were dreamed up. I think we were the first ones to integrate the radio speaker with the radio and put it in the top of the instrument panel. We originated large plastic panels on the dash, or the instrument panel. We came up with a concealed running board for the Zephyrs. We came up with this integrated license plate light and rear trunk lid handle all in one assembly. We started the low radiator grill theme with the 38 Zephyr. We integrated the instrument cluster into the steering column and wheel, I think on the first 39 Mercury. And we started with the Mercuries these body cross sections where there was quite a angle to the side glass of the doors. I'd like to start section 5, which are some of my personal projects that I was involved in the design department in those 1937 to 42 years. My claim to fame involves my work on the first, what became the first Continental. Edsel Ford, as I understood it, had been to the had been to Europe for a vacation and was impressed with the long hood, spare tires on the back type of sports cars that he saw, or luxury convertibles. And when he came back, why, he asked Gregory if they could make such a car for him by making it out of the Lincoln Zephyr. And I was chosen to work for Gregory in doing a tent size model and a tent size drawing of this effort for Edsel's car. And what was done was we had a they were black wooden modeling tables on casters, which would support a tent size modeling bridge. And one of these was moved over close to Gregory's desk in the corner of the department. And our area was partitioned off with some of these full-size blackboard creations that were also on wheels for doing full-size blackboard drawings. We partitioned off this little area where I was to work near Gregory's desk, so that when Mr. Edsel Ford came in to look at this thing, why, he wouldn't be exposed to everybody else's stares, I guess, or at least he wouldn't be noticed. And this was sometime in October 1938, and the story and this activity is in a magazine called Car Life Magazine for April 1967, if you want to look up some of the story on it. But anyhow, this is when Edsel would come in once or twice a week and look at the progress. And if he'd come in, he'd always nod very courteously and say hello. And if Gregory wasn't around at the time, I'd, of course, rush out and find him and bring him back in there. And Gregory and Mr. Edsel Ford would confer at the clay model and the drawing and look it over. And I would discreetly sneak up as close as I thought I could to hear any comments firsthand. And this was also when I was able to observe the beautiful tweed suit with the perfectly tailored cuffs and the hand-benched leather shoes, and so on, very tastefully and conservatively dressed Edsel. And so this, among my associates anyway, was my sort of claim to fame there as working on this car, which became the first Continental. What was done is I understood initially that they were going to build three of these things, one for Edsel and one for Henry II and one for Benson, the two older sons. And I think only one was built. And I have a photograph in my file of the car that was built over at the old Lincoln plant on Warren and Livernois. And the picture's taken in the back of the plant near the railroad tracks. And this was painted, as I remember, in a silver-gray color, which was sort of Edsel's favorite. And the car was shipped down to Palm Beach when Edsel was down there on vacation. And he got such a wide, favorable response to this automobile that when he came back from vacation, why, he directed that it be put into production. What we did basically was take the Zephyr and lengthen the hood and front fenders about 10 inches, as I remember, and then design a convertible top and a boxy back end with a exposed spare, and it was, for its time, it was quite a smart-looking piece of machinery, and had the Zephyr, Lincoln Zephyr grill, and I think Gregory himself designed a hood ornament for it. But anyway, that was Edsel's personal contribution, and it was put into production as the Continental. It would be Mark I, and we're up to, what, 7 today, I guess. I also worked on a 1939 Mercury full-size clay model. I think when I got in there, the body contours of that car were all, when I got in 1937, I think the body contours of that 39 Mercury were all established, but the grills were not. And I worked under Beneke's direction, as I remember, for making, modeling the grill for the front end. But one assignment I got was making a tent size plaster model of a 39 Mercury coupe for Larry Sheldrick's daughter. Now, Larry Sheldrick was chief engineer at that time, and he was a rather short, florid-faced individual, and worked upstairs with some of the other girls that were up in the secretarial pool, which included my wife. And what the deal was that Mr. Sheldrick was going to give his daughter a Mercury coupe for her birthday or some such event. And he wanted to place this little model or have it delivered to her in a box or something like that, so she'd open it up and then he could tell her that the real one was outside in the driveway and hand her the keys. Well, this was where I made the tent size model of the Mercury using the available production type drawings of that car, which was no big problem. Tent size is sort of fussy work because your scale is so small. But I didn't know anything about making plaster models, and this is where Dick Beneke came over and he showed me how to make a mold and how to put the mold together so it was all keyed together, and when you turned it upside, the top piece was for the roof, you turned it upside down, it was like an open bathtub. And he put little copper wires in where the air to reinforce the A-pillars. And he showed me how to put a release agent in the mold so that the plaster wouldn't stick, and then put the plaster in. And of course, this was right up his alley as an old-time industrial sculptor, and he did most of the work on the plaster model. But it was a wonderful piece of instruction to get from him. So when we pulled the plaster was dry, we pulled the model out of the mold while the painters went to work on it and painted it up real nice, and that was a little model for Larry Sheldrick's daughter. My other claim to fame among my associates there was in connection with a 1941 Ford. The 41 Ford and Mercury were to have common bodies, and the models of the bodies were pretty well established, as I remember, early in those in our time there in the design department, and I think maybe Emmett and I and a couple other guys helped slap some of the clay on those full-size models when we first got in. But in any event, the plan that was put forward was that there would be a Ford full-size clay model and there would be a Mercury full-size clay model. The
Mercury car was to be 4 inches longer in wheelbase from the dash forward, and it would have its own hood and front end sheet metal grill and some ornamentation, and the Ford would have its own front end sheet metal and grill and ornamentation. Well, I was assigned to work on the front end of the 41 Ford model, and normally what would happen would be that there would be some preliminary sketches of a new car line that would be reviewed with Mr. Gregory and Edsel Ford, and this might result in a small-scale model or two and some approval to subsequently do this in a full-size model. But in this case, when I was assigned to this 41 Ford front end of this full-size model, I was getting absolutely no direction from anybody on what this front end was to be like. And so what I did was, we all knew what the legal height requirement was for the seal beam headlights, and from the chassis layouts, I knew where the top tank of the radiator was, and I established those hard points in the model, and then went hell-bent for election like a beaver to work up a design on the clay model of my own, out of my own head, without any drawings or anything else. And I just put it together as fast as I could. And one day when old beady-eyed Gregory came in, why, he sort of walked past the front end model, and those beady eyes did a little double take, and he walked back and took a look at it and walked around it. And his mustache twitched a couple times, and he says, "Yeah, that's not too bad." And lo and behold, that got approved as the front end of the 41 Ford. And that sort of thing could happen today by no stretch of the imagination. And it was sort of illustrated how the design department was a small-scale outfit, and individual contributions would pop up here and there and everywhere. So I look back on the 41 Ford with fondness, because it was my own little creation. As I remember, Dick Bonnike came over with one of his fine scrapers and took a few passes at the hood just so that he could say he had something to do with it. But that was, I think, the German personality and the feeling that maybe he was the boss and should have his input someplace. I also worked on this stiff architectural type front end for the Lincoln, which I think was for a 41 model, based on that Cadillac 60 Special that I mentioned before. I worked on the Lincoln model where we developed the concealed running board, and there the front cut line of the front door was kind of tricky to make sure that when the door was open you didn't gouge into the remaining part of the sheet metal that concealed the running board. And I was privileged to do the Mercury grill, I think, for 1940 under Bonnike's direction, and the 39 Zephyr grill. And I did a lot of tent size concept or advanced models based on these impossible sketches from Gregory. But the thing there was that you were permitted to introduce your own ideas and come up with innovations from your own imagination. And these little models were just fun to work on, because they you'd do the whole car, and you could create something that started with his sketch idea and developed into a concept where the whole thing represented an integrated design. It wasn't like somebody did the front end and somebody else did the rear end and the middle got lost. It was a complete flowing surface from one end to the other, and had sort of the same feel throughout. So these tent-sized models were lots of fun to work on. And then another thing that I think I drew up at home and brought in were little decorative clips for the early Ford and Mercury steering wheels. Now, these steering wheels had wire spokes. I think maybe each spoke was a half a dozen individual wires, which started out at the hub area fairly wide, and they gradually got closer together and sort of joined each other as they hit the rim. And someplace along in there, there were clips that surrounded these individual wires and sort of kept them all together. And at home, I had sketched up 8 or 10 ideas for the style, the grooves and general shape for these little ornamental and functional wire spoke clips. Well, I brought them in and brought the drawing in. Everybody got a chuckle out of it, and Johnny Walder is a pretty salty guy anyway. He sent me a note later on after I'd been long gone from there and included a snippy little note with a print of this damn drawing of these steering wheel clips, and says, here, Buster, in your spare time, drop a million of these for me, will you? And it's a difficult Johnny Walder. The other thing that I came away with from the design department were a couple of prints of the layouts that I did for instrument panels. And these were instrument panels that I think found their way into the Mercury car line, and were reminders that we were all sort of jacks of all trades, and we did drawings as well as models and renderings and actual pieces of hardware. I'd like now to get into item number 6 on my outline, which I've called the later experiences which touch on the design center activity. And this would be from my total Ford experience from first being in the design department in 37 until I retired in 81. One important thing I think that happened in the engineering product area there was the creation of liaison committees. Each car group, as I remember, Ford and Lincoln Mercury, were required to establish such a committee. And what it amounted to was, prior to that time, engineering would design a product and sort of throw it in the mail chute, and manufacturing would take what they saw and try and create it. And when the product didn't turn out real well, why, engineering pointed the finger at manufacturing, and they pointed the finger at engineering, and the dealer pointed the fingers at both of them, and the customer was pretty frustrated. And what this type of liaison activity did was really to formalize a philosophy and a practice that Joe Feltz and his assistant Sid Frears in our Lincoln Mercury chassis group practiced actually in our own group. And this was to work closely with manufacturing as the product was developed. And this was a wonderful idea, which these committees, which sort of broke down the walls between organizations, and it created a realization that all the activities had to work in concert for the benefit of the customer and the company. And it affected the design center, since early designs had to be practical to make, assemble, and satisfy functional and service criteria. So these committees reviewed, for example, instrument panels in the design center, and led to later in my area, where we actually required our design engineers to sign off on the assembly process sheets after we had reviews down in the design aid room in Building 5. But there was no more, gradually, there was no more of this draw it up and toss it over the wall to manufacturing approach. We kept them informed of what was going on, and working with the design center, their personnel became better designers as they began to appreciate the functional criteria and requirements and understand the manufacturing and the assembly needs. We also were involved in Lincoln Mercury Chassis, for example, with the creation of some of the special show cars, and one of these was the X100 Lincoln. This car had electric jacks, which were built into the car, and boy, when we first got those things and put them on, they just didn't work worth a damn. They would stall and bind halfway up, and that was a heavy automobile. We had been relying on a supplier to do all the work, and when we ran into trouble, we got our engineer, Dave Miller, to go back to square one and make some basic engineering calculations, and geez, it turned out that those screw jacks had to be about 95% efficient if this whole thing was going to work. So we got the vendor in again and completely redid the ball nut screws so that they would run free and be efficient and everything. And finally, we got them working just fine. But that was a real tussle. And the design center was involved with our effort, or we were involved with theirs, I should say, in the engine compartment, which was color coordinated and styled to suit the rest of the car. We had the front end of the frame painted that beautiful green. The engine was painted, and the controls were chrome plated. And I remember the power steering hoses. We had brushed chrome fittings on the ends, and we put a nice green vinyl sleeve on the hose so that they would match the color of everything else under the hood. One of the other regular contacts with styling was on package space needs for various components. And the package requirements govern this flexibility that the designers in styling really have. And one one incident along this line I recall quite well was a meeting with Mr. McNamara. This was on the 61 Lincoln program, and that Lincoln was supposed to be a more compact, efficient package, lower and whatnot than our great big monster of a 58 through 60 Lincoln. And so it was a tighter space package, and what we found when we began to lay the thing out was that clearances in the engine compartment between various components were just impractical. They were just too damn tight, and there would have been all sorts of problems. So the only solution was to widen the front tread. Well, the tread dimension was one of the sacred package specifications that had been cast in concrete with Mr. McNamara and his committee. And so Harold McDonald asked me if I would go over to the Oval Styling Conference Room with him and present the need to widen the front tread. I think we widened it an inch or something like that. And what I did was go over there early with Harold, and I put up colored layout prints on the wall so I could point to these different clearance conditions and explain why we had to widen the front tread. And this, of course, would have some effect on the front fender cutouts in the design center and may affect the approved model. But anyway, when my turn came, I got up and started to go through these prints, pointing out the clearance between this and there and saying it was inadequate for this reason, and going to the second one, and I got to about the second drawing, and Mr. McNamara stopped me and says, "Can you explain this whole thing in just a few words?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I think I can." I said, "What it amounts to is when you have a V8 engine, as we have here, and you squash this thing down low, things have to squirt out sideways." And he says, "Oh, okay, fine, approved." And that's all there was to it. And I'll have to say this, McNamara may be a certified turdhead in somebody people's mind, but that was the most efficient darn meeting I was ever in all my life. I remember the guy before me was some planner, and he had a presentation brochure with a bunch of pages in there with nothing but columns of figures, and he was plodding through his story page by page, and McNamara, I looked over, and he was flipping pages pretty fast, and he got to the end and flipped the cover down on this brochure and stopped the guy and gave him a decision right then and there. He'd analyze it, that whole damn thing in a matter of just a few minutes, and there was no need for this guy to plow through the rest of the figures, and he just gave him the decision and shut him off. So I was tremendously impressed with the efficiency of that meeting. I don't know whether McNamara screwed up the World Bank in the meantime, but he sure as hell ran that meeting in a good fashion. The other thing that came out of my later experience was that we any number of times had to caution vendors against trying to sell their own ideas to the design center before they had any kind of an engineering review or approval for function. A lot of suppliers would sell wherever they could, try to get an okay, ignoring purchasing or engineering, and would generally get themselves in trouble. And one of these cases had to do with wire wheels. There was a small outfit in Indiana that thought they knew how to make wire wheels, and they had gone into Design Center and sold the designers there on a couple of these wire wheel designs, and we had reviewed them and told them that they just wouldn't function the way the spokes were laced because they couldn't stand any torque. Well, they didn't quite believe us in the Design Center, so we had the vendor make up a pair of these wheels, and we put them on the back wheels of a car and got some designers to go over to the test track with us there in Dearborn, made what would be sort of a normal startup, not a certified jackrabbit start, and sure enough, these wire wheels sort of wrapped themselves up and came apart on one stop. So the designers were convinced, and subsequently, by working closely with the designers, we engineers were able to establish the proper relationships and avoid some of these problems. If this same sort of problem related to material suppliers as well. They would make a hard sell for some new material they came up with, even though the application was all wrong. And they'd try and sell it to the design center. DuPont used to be one of the offenders there. They'd sell nylon to make any damn thing, whether it would work or not. And what would trap us in engineering was that perhaps our engineers had made something the same way for so long that they never set up any functional test criteria. It had always been done the same way, and always, in fact, probably carry over drawings. And when a new material or process was proposed, well, we had to go back quick like a bunny and analyze our prior parts and review the service experience and set up a test program to prove out some criteria. And then a quick check on the new designs for whether they would function satisfactorily and have adequate life and so on. And as a result, as time went on, we were clearly separating function and appearance considerations. When our objective there was to set the functional requirements very clearly and allow all the freedom that was possible for the designers to make the appearance satisfactory. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. That's what we tried to do. And along that same continuing on somewhat in that same line, my item number 7 is some thoughts on automotive design, or for that matter, any product design and development activity. And here, I found that designers and engineers kind of get tunnel vision. They look at the problems that are sitting on their desk and forget about the big picture a lot of times. And they forget that the company is in existence to make a profit for its owners and shareholders, basically. And this means that it must sell its products to the public at a price that they can afford and which produces a profit. So therefore, costs are vital. And these points raise a number of questions that really make you ask, what does the consumer really want? And what does the consumer really need? And then more importantly, what's he willing to buy? And to what degree can our products break new ground appearance-wise and function-wise? Do we assign one car line to be a new style risk line? Or do we follow GM or European custom makers and never lead any place? And how fast can we change a car if it turns out to be a non-winner? And what features do we really have that can be useful in advertising to convince the customer to buy our products rather than somebody else? And I think a designer or an engineer should have these thoughts in mind as he goes about his work every day. I'm taping over this reel number 4, the last part of it, and hope that it turns out to be one you can hear, because on the first playback, why, the sound was so faint and the recording was so poor, I didn't think it could be useful. So if it seems like I'm hurrying here, why, I am. And I hope the overtaping works out well. I actually feel that a great deal of General Motors' success over the years has been because their cars, style-wise, appeal to the what I call the median poor taste of the U.S. consumer. And the portholes on a Buick, maybe, is an example. And I think you can't afford to try to be a style leader and innovator all the time on all of your products. The risk is just too great. If a particular style doesn't appeal to the public, you've lost the whole ball game and have to close up shop. If it's only one car line, a quick facelift might fix it, or the other car lines will, or other product line will keep the ship afloat. And I think you can say that time has shown that everything else being equal, appearance will sell. But appearance alone isn't the overriding factor, and the designers have to recognize that compromises, as they would see it, for reasons of serviceability and reliability and economy, whether it's economy of manufacturing or assembly or some new material, is real important.